Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Callie Crossley here with Sue O'Connell in for Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. The latest thing that has clearly highlighted the class divide in America is the affluenza defense. 16-year-old Eric Couch killed four people while driving under the influence. Prosecutors asked for the maximum sentence of 20 years in juvenile hall. Instead, Crouch got off with 10 years probation. Crouch's defense team argued that he suffered from affluenza. Because of his family's wealth and lax child rearing style, Crouch never learned that his actions had consequences. So does this suggest that with the wealth gap comes a moral accountability gap? Joining us, as she does every Tuesday, to discuss this is Nancy Kane. She's an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration. And her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Welcome back, Nancy.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks, Kelly.
I have to say, this is a story that just made my stomach turn. Yeah. It just makes no sense, and I'm still struggling with it, and I just find it horrific. Again, this 16-year-old killed four people under the influence, it seems, and he said, it's not my fault.
Right.
My parents raised me this way. I'm wealthy. I don't have to take responsibility. And it's not my fault. This is how I was raised.
You know, it's really astounding. And it recalls to mind for some of the viewers that, you know, can reach back in their memory banks, the Twinkie defense.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah.
Way back in the late 70s, a guy named Dan White, right, walked into City Hall in San Francisco and killed George Moscone, who was the mayor, and the city supervisor, Harvey Milk. And his defense psychologists and legal team came up with this kind of, complete lack of accountability defense, saying he ate so much junk food, right, that he wasn't thinking well, right? He was crazed. And you know, it really has some kind of frightening and very, very, you know, disillusioning parallels to that. So it's important for, you know, our listeners to realize that Ethan Couch, the 16-year-old, killed four pedestrians. It wasn't that it was a, you know, he turned too fast or he went through a red light. He killed people that were bystanders and injured several others. And again, as Callie so carefully summarized it, you know, he was led off by virtue of a psychologist, Dick Miller's testimony, that who used the term affluenza, that because of his sheltered, privileged upbringing, he lives in a gated community north of Dallas, right? He did not ever learn, in some sense, thou shall not drive a Ford 350 pickup at high speeds with six other people in the car and hit pedestrians and kill them.
You know, my two, I had the same reaction Callie had, but I also had a different reaction. You know, on one hand, it's just disgusting that this is a wealth-based class issue, when one could make the opposite argument in the same way for many people who are arrested on the other spectrum.
Absolutely.
You know, that you robbed the bank because you had no money because you didn't know that there was a way to get a job. Or
because your mother was working two jobs and didn't have a lot of time with you.
If this is going to work for him, it should work for just about everyone else who comes up in front of a judge. And at the same time, you know, we're finding a lot of progress in the neuroscience world around development. You know, we have talked about teenagers and whether or not they can be held accountable for anything, because science shows us where their brain development is. And there's a neuroscientist called, his name is Jim Fallon, who's done a lot of work on the sociopath and where their brains are. And he's made an argument that, you know, sociopaths might need to be held to a different standard of punishment than someone who's not a sociopath. You know, that it doesn't mean that they're not to be punished, but can they truly be held accountable for a way that their brain works? And, you know, so I'm both outraged that this kid got this pass and the community there seems to be okay with it, and it really speaks to the terrible race and class divide in this country. But on the other hand, we have science showing us that, you know, there is a lot of impact of science on our brains and our decision making.
Well, all right, let's take that, right? But remember that the law, so we're really talking about the law here, right? and how the law is administered. So a judge, I mean, he was guilty. So that wasn't an issue of guilt. It was an issue of punishment, right? The judge, Judge Jean Boyd in Texas, sentenced him to a therapeutic center, right? You know, on the grounds that this would probably do more good for him, perhaps mm-hmm. along some kind of developmental road, not so dissimilar from the one you're talking about, Sue. And he's going to spend, I forget how many years, but several years in an enclosed facility where there's an equine center mm-hmm. and organic foods and a gymnasium, and his father's going to pay the $450,000 a year for him to be there. So there's a, you know, clearly everywhere you look, there are dollar signs around this. But the law doesn't exist purely to interpret science. It doesn't exist purely to interpret motive. It doesn't exist purely, if you will, to in some sense represent class. What the law exists for something actually much more transcends those potential purposes. And that is to safeguard a civil and organized and morally centered society, right? It has very pragmatic kind of purpose to it. So let's think about this and science in the context of that kind of goal. And think, so one of the interesting things about this sentence, right, is yes, it says something about race and class, you know, and you could talk about all kinds of different, you know, people from Klaus von Bülow to, mm-hmm. to O.J. Simpson mm-hmm. in some kind of vein like that. But it also sends a very, very powerful and I think very destructive signal out there to all kinds of young people about what you can do, how much latitude you have, if you will, to function in society. And again, the law exists largely to, in some sense, constrain that latitude within reasonable means so that we can live in safety and with respect for others in some kind, again, morally centered way. And every which way you look at it from that kind of perspective, from the purpose of the law, it seems to me this verdict does the law a great injustice. Because not only does it send, I think, a very poor signal to other people, but it says something about what we will accept as a society. Do we really want to live in a society where not only this kind of race and class issue, right, seems so unbalanced, but in which we're just not going to say to young people, thou shalt not do this under any circumstances.
And there will be consequences to pay.
And you will have consequences when you step outside the limits. And that is incredibly important. It's incredibly important for almost any kind of cognitive creature that interacts with other cognitive creatures.
But what's the message that it sends the parents? I mean, that's the other part. I've been joking earlier. I don't want any punishment on any parents since I have a teenager. But at the same time, you know, and this is not, this is definitely a class race conversation, or at least a class conversation. These are parents who had the means to raise a child properly. You know, there's no discussion of people were working, people had issues, you know.
They couldn't expose them to enough.
There's no excuse for a child to be raised this way. So in a sense, these parents are being punished. I mean, as lucky as they are that their son is not going to jail, they have to pay for this. They're paying $1 million plus to rectify.
But they're so wealthy, Sue. This is nothing for them.
Right, but
you know?
Is this a way to hold parents accountable?
No, quite the opposite,
I
think,
don't think,
right?
So?
It says at some, you know, kind of generalizable level that if you have the means and the connections, which usually are connected to material or monetary wealth, then you can, you know, you have an extraordinary amount of latitude and a lack of responsibility and accountability to raise your children according to recognized moral and behavioral precepts. I think every which way you look at this, the verdict, and this is why there's been so much outrage. There's been outrage among the Texas gubernatorial candidates. There's been outrage among other lawyers. There's a petition on the internet which has gathered 20,000 signatures against the judge's ruling. There are going to be civil suits. Several of the victims' families mm-hmm. have already announced civil suits. So there's a lot of uproar around this. And I think it's around all these things, but I think it's around one thing that's perhaps even larger, or that encompasses all of what we're talking about, and that is, it suggests that at some level our society is a little bit off its rails. It's a little off its rails if we can't say to a teenager, and let's account for developmental mm-hmm. differences, But it's one thing to account for those differences, be it a sociopath or a teenager or a six-year-old or, you know, brain differences, but to account for them within reasonable limits. And that's not been done here. It suggests that, you know, in this, you know, it's holiday moment, right, when we're to take stock of what goodness is and how it is around us and all of the people and creatures in our lives that provide that to us. And, you know, really, in some sense, to stand back on our heels as decent human beings, it is in some ways an affront to that. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Because it says that decency, we can all agree on mm-hmm. that word, is not going to be served by the legal system. Right? And that again suggests at a very large level, have we really just lost our like moral and kind of, you know, social center here?
Well, Nancy Kane, historian at the Harvard Business School, this article in the New York Times suggests that because all of the things that you mentioned, the petition, the outrage, the article from James McCauley suggests that that came from the outside, that if you walk around North Texas where this case is centered,
right.
People are like, shrugging their shoulders. Wasn't it ever thus? And I refer back to something, a conversation that you had with Jim and Marjorie, you know, a couple of weeks ago when you were talking about the splendid isolation of the very, very wealthy.
I guess Warren Zevon before him, excuse me.
And what was happening, you know, in a general sense, even before we start talking about this specific case. Yeah. So is this part and parcel of that? Is this, are the people in North Texas who are essentially shrugging their shoulders right in that this is what's happening now?
You know, so that's a very, very interesting question. So, you know, the flash that comes into my head is a phrase, and I want to say it's from Edward Wolfe, who's a very well-known economist of income and wealth equality or inequality in New York. But it may not be his, so let me be careful. But we're a term coined by an economist about how America has become, you know, a land of skyboxes, right? Large, you know, expensive boxes at sporting arenas that you can rent if you're very wealthy and hold your private parties there and be glassed in and separate. And there's a little bit of that, right, in this splendid isolation. Now, if I lived in you know, one of these suburbs and this had happened to one of my neighbors, you can imagine that at some level your first reaction would be to shrug your shoulders, even if that's not necessarily all that you felt. Because a little bit of it is like, you know, see no evil, hear no evil. Is this my lot? Am I raising my kids like this? You know, in some sense, guilt or some kind of intimation of similar behavior by virtue of where you live. On the other hand, again, and we all do that, right? We all do that within our groups, within our villages. Oh, well, I see that over here, but, you know, it's not a big deal because I'm part of this same, you know, county or if you will, landscape. On the other hand, right, Nietzsche is often quoted as having said this. I'm not sure that's right. But, you know, nothing is necessary for the triumph of evil, but for good men to do nothing.
Right.
So what are we doing, all of us, not just those of us in North Dallas, not just those of us that are privileged and lucky enough to live in gated communities, not just those of us that are lucky to live within a stone's throw of 02138, right? Cambridge's zip code and all the information and possibility that exists in a different kind of, you know, community of great power and privilege, Harvard. Right. What are we all doing by not saying more about something that most of us consider to have feel a serious element of outrage about?
Let me ask you back to the law point. How long do you think it's going to be before a defense attorney has the poverenza defense, if you will, that my client was poor and could not have made this decision correctly? How is it? I mean, part of this I'm appalled at is at the law system, you know, at the lawyers and I get that you pay to get the best defense and you want the best defense
and you want your child not to go to jail.
Totally get it. But at the same time, you know, to come up with this and to offer this in the world that we live in now. But how long do you think it's going to be before we hear this as a defense?
Well, you know, not very long, right? Because the law is all about what goes precedent, right? What works in one case then becomes, for lawyers and judges and legal scholars, the possibility of something that's generalizable and can work in many other roughly similar cases or roughly analogous cases. So not long. How well is it going to work without a top-notch legal team that can buy top-notch expert witnesses to corroborate their frame on the case? You know, that's a separate question, right?
But if someone decides a law firm wants to be the activist law firm.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. But again, then we're back to kind of Jim Brody, who likes to kind of you know, beat this dead horse. It's an important horse to, well, I don't want to say beat, but it's an important horse to kind of keep in the race, and that is, where is the accountability? Right. Mm-hmm. We talked about at the very top of the, very bottom of the hour at 12:30. Where is the accountability in all this? All we're doing is passing the buck for something that affects all of us every single day, which is the way we show up on the streets, behind our wheel, right, in a bank, right, in the street, in front of our colleagues. How do we show up in civil society? Every single infringement like this, which is extraordinarily severe, right, and then the way it's handled chips away at our sense of decency and what goes for accountable, responsible behavior.
And I would suggest that it chips away at our sense of being an American. And I will say this, in that because we believe that there are systems in place to equalize a scenario so that you can, even if you're not the one in the gated community and the truth is on your side, so to speak, you can come out okay. And to see the faces of those families after that courtroom, it was so stunning. Because they just couldn't believe.
They couldn't believe it. This was happening in America. I couldn't agree with you more. And you think about, President Barack Obama's speech in early December when he was talking about, it's now being called the, inequality speech, when he was talking about what's happening to our sense of Americans as a rising people. And he specifically talked about exactly that, equality of opportunity, right? You work hard, you play by the rules, right? And your kids and you can get ahead. Everything like this just, it knocks a big hunk of the marble of that icon off. I just think it's tremendously dangerous for us. You know, there's one other thing that I'm really struck by. So this is Christmas Eve, and I was saying this to a friend on the phone last night. So, I'm struck by how much plenty there is among, certainly in my life, how much plenty there is. And then, I talked to, Father O'Brien, who runs Cor Unum, this very, very, very successful food kitchen in Lawrence, Massachusetts. They feed thousands of meals every day and have been for years and years and years. Anyone, as long as you don't carry a weapon, can be fed there. Mm-hmm. Right? And there are hundreds of people lining up to eat. So you have this massive contrast, right? But A verdict like this actually only accentuates the contrast. The haves have all the goodies, have all the power. This is what Barack Obama is saying. He says, don't let us lose equality of opportunity so we lose our sense of what makes it special to be an American. We're doing that. And as a historian, I sit back and I just get a little bit nervous. It's beginning to smell a little like the late 18th century to me. Yep. Let them eat cake.
I got to tell on a personal note,
I just wrote a commentary about the food situation or the lack thereof for so many people at this time of plenty in this nation.
I didn't know if it was for me just a mark of getting older, but I have a harder time every night going to sleep at night with how much I have, I don't really have that much. Yeah. I mean, comparatively. Yeah. And it's really just, it's a scary time in that
it's
sense.
It's a scary time.
Because desperate people do desperate things, too, which is the other part of it. And the desperate people who do desperate things are not going to do it to the 1%.
Nope.
We're kind of all in this mix together.
You bet. You bet.
Well,
Merry Christmas.
Was a really depressing conversation.
Okay, now let's just take a deep yoga breath.
Yes.
And remember that every day most people get up
and do the right thing.
And do the right thing and have
stop
an interaction.
Stop signs.
Right? In their Starbucks counter or with their with their school crossing guard, and goodness is flowing.
Thank you very much, Nancy Kane. Nancy Kane is an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Nancy, have a great Christmas.
Yeah. And to you, happy Christmas.
Thank you. And when we come back, we're getting a jump start on Christmas by way of music. Eric Jackson, the Dean of Jazz, joins us next for his favorite jazz variations on classic Christmas songs. That's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.